So let me begin by saying, this is the gospel season. This is the gospel season. This is the season where the gospel, you know, the gospel ought always to be very real to us and very poignant and powerful. But this is the season, the Lenten season, where we focus on the gospel and its potency, its meaning, its effect in our lives more than maybe any other time of the year. Because before long we will observe and even celebrate, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ and his death, and we will celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the grave, and thereby give us hope that we too can be resurrected because he has broken the power of sin and death for us in that way. So as we look at that then, this being the gospel season, we are studying in this Lenten series, Isaiah 52 verses 13 through 15 and Isaiah 53 verses 1 through 12. I spoke last week as a part of the introduction to help us, you know, zero in on the significance of Isaiah 53. I spoke on types of Christ. And so I went over a few that the Old Testament has that were placed there intentionally to prepare us for Jesus in that way. So, you know, the Passover, for example, was one of the illustrations that I gave that's located in the Old Testament. And then, but I think it's helpful as a part of the introduction to remind us also, you know, there are various ways in which Christ has revealed himself throughout the Old Testament. So there are types, there are symbols of Christ-like examples in the Old Testament. And then there's just good old-fashioned kind of theology, right? And so I've done a series on this numerous times, but some of you may not have heard it, and so I just want to remind us. I'm not going to spend much time on it at all, but to remind us and to sensitize us to help sensitize us to Isaiah 53. So you will remember that I've taught and take a position on what is called the covenantal approach to how we understand the work of Christ. That is to say, that when Adam and Eve fell, it wasn't like God was taken by surprise. He wasn't embarrassed. He wasn't humiliated because Satan got won over on him, right? So God knew that was going to happen and had, as a part of that knowing, a plan to compensate for what did take place. You might ask the question, well, why did God allow that? And so I will tell you, I do not know. So, And nor does anybody else. You know, it's all part of God's overarching plan, and so we are players in that overarching plan. And as obedient and submissive, loving people of His, we accept that. And perhaps we'll learn someday when we end up on the other side. So there are four primary covenants. I'm just going to go through them very quickly. There's what's called the Abrahamic covenant. So this also functions as a type of Christ as well, but there's the Abrahamic covenant that God would, through Abraham, establish a people of God who would learn what it would mean to be justified by faith. It's the Abrahamic covenant. There's the text for you that you would find it. And that in that covenant, God promised through Abraham a land that through his lineage there would be a great people or nation, that his name would become great. You know, he is the father of two of the world's major religions, right? So his name would become great, that Israel, his people, would enjoy protection from him, and that through him, in his lineage and his people, the nations would be blessed. So this wasn't just for Israel, it was for the whole world that God established the Abrahamic covenant. And then the second would be the Mosaic covenant, the covenant through Moses. And in that covenant, the law of God was established, and that Moses functioned as a mediator and intercessor before God in the same way that Jesus functions for us as a mediator and intercessor for God, right? But one of the very important key components of that was that the law was given, and that that law could be summed up in the Ten Commandments, what we call the Decalogue. And so those are the Ten Commandments. They are what you would call apodictic laws. An apodictic law means that it applies to everyone, everywhere, at all times. It applies to everyone, everywhere, at all times. The law of God does not apply just to the Israelites. It applies to the entire world. And so this Decalogue, this Ten Commandments, is summed up in these particular laws. And so, you know, and I've done a series on this, but you know, you could spend a long time unpacking the significance of all of this in the lives of our, you know, humanity. So that was the essence of the Abrahamic covenant, or I'm sorry, the Mosaic covenant. And then we have what's called the Davidic covenant, the covenant through David. And that through David, a man who was after God's own heart, God would establish an eternal king that he would call his son. And that through the lineage of David, a kingdom would be established forever and ever. So that was not hyperbole. That was not an embellishment. That through the lineage of David would come a man who would be king, and he would rule over the world forever and ever. Now, understand that Israel was this little sliver of a country located in the backwaters of everywhere in the world, right? I mean, it was like nowhere. And for these kinds of aspirations and declarations to take place out of this little tiny itty-bitty country, I mean, many people would have thought that would have been the height of arrogance, right? But again, you know, in God's providence, if you're going to create a religion that's going to impact the entire world, then you would locate it exactly where Israel is, because that was the crossroads of the world. You would locate it in a place where this interesting language called Greek would emerge, because Greek is probably the best language you could come up with when you wanted to write about and talk about the technicalities, the specifics, the important particularities of a religious faith. Greek is probably the best language to do that with. It was all part of God's providence, right? And then all of these covenants were fulfilled in Christ. And so when we read, when Jesus gives Lord, when Jesus does the Lord's Supper, this, you know, he talks about how the covenant is fulfilled in his blood. All of that coalesces on Christ himself. So that is the fourth and the final covenant. So we read then about Christ in the Old Testament and Isaiah's description and prophecy of the Messianic King. Now, it's interesting that we talked last week, and I know that this is like more of a teaching thing, and I hope that you're okay with that, but I'm so excited about Isaiah 53 and the significance that it has for us at this time of the year. So there's a lot of teaching that goes with it, and so a little less preaching in some respects, but a lot more teaching, and I hope that you can appreciate the significance of this particular passage as we unpack it. So remember last week, we talked about there are two sections to the book of Isaiah. The first section is Isaiah 1 through 39. In Isaiah 1 through 39, that's the section they talk about where there's Isaiah is prophesying about Israel's sin and its unrepentant sin. and it's horrifically unrepentant sin. And because they are that way, there is judgment and there will be alienation. And so Isaiah talks about that in all 39 chapters. And then there's this switch from Isaiah 40 to Isaiah 66. And the language and the themes are entirely different. And it's a language of hope. It's a language of redemption. It's a language of forgiveness. It's a language of provision that Isaiah says God is going to provide. In that second section, Isaiah 40 through 66, there's another subsection. And in that subsection, in chapters 42, 49, 50, and 53, we have what are called the songs of the suffering servant. The songs of the suffering servant in that second section. You with me? Okay. Now, before I talk about the songs of the suffering servant, I want to give you a little background so that you can appreciate the significance of those songs even more. And so, let's go back to Samuel, who lived about 300 years before Isaiah. And Samuel was a Levite, a judge, and also the first true prophet in the Old Testament. You know, I would say that Samuel, for 2,000 years, is probably one of the most underappreciated, one of the least talked about, less written about major figures in the whole of the Old Testament. Samuel was a Levite. He was a priest. Samuel lived during the time when they did not have a king, so he was a judge. And I don't know what you know about judges during that time, but judges were charismatic figures who rose up into leadership during prominent times in the history of Israel when they were being attacked, when they had to go to war, when there was some kind of major controversy, but they were a charismatic leader who rose up. Samuel was a judge who endured for decades. Here's the interesting thing about Samuel. Samuel was one of the few biblical figures who never had a major sin issue, a major controversy. One of the few figures where no one looked back over the life of Samuel and said, well, yeah, he was a good guy, but he did this. There are no incidences where that happened in the life of Samuel. Don't exist. Now, people might say, well, but Samuel's sons were kind of like pretty iffy. Well, that's true. But do your children always do what you want them to do when they become adults? No. No, they don't, right? I mean, you can't always control what your kids do, right? You can do everything right and still have some of your kids not turn out so well. Well, that's probably what happened with Samuel's sons. But Samuel, as a biblical figure, was a remarkable person. So he was the first true prophet in the Old Testament. He was the first one to foretell of a messianic hope even before Israel had a king. So we read in 2 Samuel verse 17, or chapter 7, I'm sorry, chapter 7, verses 13 and 16, where he says this: He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. And so this is a prophecy of a messianic king that Samuel talks about before Israel. In fact, this was right before they established David or Saul as king, as the first king of Israel. So then we just look at this outline and you can see that around 1250 was when Joshua invaded the land of Canaan. They left Egypt, they wandered around for 40 years, and then they invaded Canaan around 1250 BCE. After that, there were the judges, and then three kings ruled: Saul, David, Solomon. Things did not end well with Solomon, where his son, Jeroboam, Solomon was a very good king for a long period of time, but he had many wives and many concubines. And those wives and concubines brought with them foreign gods. And there was a lot of idol worship that began to take place later on in Solomon's life. Not only that, Solomon was the one who built the temple and he built the palace. And he taxed his people very heavily, and they resented it. And so when his son took power, Jeroboam, the people said, we need a break from taxes. I'm sure you've never said that before, but they said, we need a break from the taxes. And he said, no, I'm not doing that. And so that caused a conflict that eventually resulted in the northern kingdom being established and the southern kingdom being established, right? And so that happened around 980 BCE. And so later on, the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians under Sennacherib at 722 BCE. And that northern kingdom never, never produced a just or righteous king. No one in the northern kingdom ever resembled Saul, for that matter, let alone David or Solomon. They were evil, wicked kings. And they too ended up worshiping the god of Molech, right? And then about 150 years or so after that, the southern kingdom fell. It finally in 586 BC. In the southern kingdom, there were a few good kings. But by and large, on the whole, Judah as well produced overwhelmingly horrible kings, terrible kings that did incredibly wicked things. In fact, the final king, Manasseh, was so evil that he did things that were worse than the Canaanites who lived there before Israel ever invaded the land of Canaan. And so from the time of Samuel on, everyone was seeking and hoping for the just, righteous, an all-powerful king of Israel in the north and in the south. And all they got, for the most part, were these horribly wicked, failed kings. And yet they would remember these prophecies that began with Samuel. Well, where is this king? Where is this Messiah? Where is this person who's going to be just and righteous? Where is this person who's going to treat us well? Where is this person who's going to be holy and good? Where is this king? They kept looking for this king. Where is he? All throughout. And during the time of Isaiah, the same thing was true. Even the original three best kings were still disasters in their own right. King Saul was arrogant, petty, and idolatrous. King David was a murderer, an idolater, and he was violent. King Solomon had too many wives and concubines and worshiped, and his wives and concubines introduced idol worship throughout the whole of the land of Israel. And so the last king of Judah, which I mentioned before, was King Manasseh. And this is, and just so you have the text for it, it says here in 1 Chronicles 33:9, Manasseh led Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem astray to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the people of Israel. Understand, the land of Canaan and the people of Canaan were destroyed because of their evil. And yet Israel, who was his arm of justice over the Canaanite tribes, became worse than the people that Israel was sent to destroy. So the last king that Isaiah served under was Manasseh. It was this king that sawed Isaiah in half with a wooden saw, as referred to in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 37. So Isaiah served under five kings. And the last few years of his life, King Manasseh rose to power, resented Isaiah's prophecies, and persecuted him and had him sawn in half with a wooden saw. But not before Isaiah completed this incredible book that he wrote with this promise. that would tell Israel where this righteous, this just, this holy, this good king was going to come from. So right before both Isaiah and Israel go dark, he finishes his book. And he basically says, there will be a righteous king who will deliver, save, and restore you. That's the second section of Isaiah. And nowhere is that more detailed and more clear than in the songs of the suffering servant in Isaiah, the second section of the particular book. And so he says, so this is not going to be merely a reigning earthly king, but a righteous and suffering king. So Israel would be looking for this like military king, right? This good guy military king who would be able to free them from the Syrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, who was going to be just and good and usher them into a whole new time of prosperity and goodness and low taxes and no slaves and all that kind of stuff. People kept asking, where is he? And so during that time that Isaiah lived and was prophesying, it looked as if all of the prophets up until that point were lying. Right? And then Isaiah writes Isaiah 40 through 66. And he writes the songs of the suffering servant. So in chapters 1 through 39, understand it was as bad as it was ever going to get. And they kept asking the question, where is the great and righteous messianic king who would rule the world? This person who would be a blessing and a light to the nations. Where is this king? And so with that in mind, then, when we look at section 2 of the book of Isaiah, we see what are called the four suffering servant songs. This suffering servant motif in the book of Isaiah, section 2, is found in chapters 42, 49, 50, and 53. Those are the chapters. And that's what we're going to look at this morning as we talk about this different kind of king. They were looking for an earthly king, but God had in mind something so much better, someone so much greater. So Isaiah describes a servant king and his sacrificial and redemptive work for forgiveness and restoration, not only for Israel, but for the entire world. I mean, look, you know, understand that most religions of the world are exclusive. They're exclusive. They exist only for the people who live in that region, who belong to that ethnicity or that race. But from the very beginning, the plan of God was to not only work through a people that he established and for their salvation, but to establish salvation for the whole world through that people. From the very beginning. This is one of the many things that makes the Christian faith utterly unique and distinctive, remarkable, and why we can with confidence lay claim to these promises that God established throughout the Old Testament and fulfilled in the New. So, some of the commentators that I read said that the suffering servant songs in Isaiah is the most complete and comprehensive section of the Messiah in the whole New Testament. There's no other place in the whole New Testament where you will get this kind of a complete and comprehensive description of the Messiah. It is here that you get the best picture of that. The song of the suffering servant answers the most important question in all of human thought, experience, and history. It answers that question. And that question is, how, when we are alienated from God, how can we be forgiven and restored into a right relationship with God so that we can have eternity with him in heaven? How is that possible? So let's, if you have your Bibles, turn to Isaiah 42. And we're just going to work our way through these. I'm not going to unpack the first three very much. We're going to spend, obviously, most of our time on the fourth psalm, the fourth song of the suffering servant, which is found in Isaiah 53. But I want you to see this section so that you get this sense of how Isaiah was brilliant, and it's amazing that he could write what he did 800 years before the birth of Christ. So in the suffering servant in Isaiah 42, the primary theme is he will establish justice. So Isaiah records, "Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not put out or quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not fail or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law." And so there's this all-encompassing effect that this servant is going to have on the whole of the world when it comes to justice. The whole of the world. Well, who can do that? What earthly king can do that? We read in the suffering servant in Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 6. So if you want to turn to that, Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 6, where he is called to deliver Israel as well as the world. "Listen to me, O coastlands, and hearken, you peoples from afar." He's talking to people more than just Israel here, right? You coastlands. So he's giving this sense of people in the expanse of the world, he's saying. "The Lord called me from the womb. From the body of my mother, he named my name." We read in the Old Testament where God speaks through Gabriel and says, "I want you to name him Jesus." Right? Verse 2, "He made my mouth like a sharp sword." When you read in the book of Revelations, you read where Jesus has a double-edged sword that he speaks with. Remember that? "He made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me a polished arrow. In his quiver, he hid me away." He made me to be effective. He made me with the ability to accomplish things that are really good and very dramatic. Verse 3, "And he said to me, you are my servant, Ebed." The word Ebed in the Hebrew means servant and or slave, or both of those. "You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified. But I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and vanity, but surely my right hand is with the Lord, and my recompense with my God. And now the Lord says, who formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob, that is Israel, back to him, that Israel might be gathered to him. For I am honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has become my strength." Verse 6, he says, "Is it too light a thing that you should be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob, to restore the preserved of Israel? I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach the ends of the earth." This was radical literature, right? Any self-respecting Israelite who would have read that would have been offended by it. What do you mean your salvation is going to be extended to the nations? We hate the nations. They've enslaved us. They've carried us off. What do you mean you're going to give salvation to the nations of the world? But that's what Isaiah says. The suffering servant in Isaiah 50, verses 4 through 6. He describes his willing and obedient suffering. Isaiah 50, verses 4 through 6. "The Lord has given me the tongue of those who are taught, that I may know how to sustain with a word him that is weary. Morning by morning he wakens. He wakens my ear to hear as those who are taught. The Lord has opened my ear, and I was not rebellious. The Lord spoke to me. He asked me to do something. I did not resist. I was not rebellious. I turned not backward. I gave back. It's so hard to read verse 6 here without. I gave my back to the smiters, my cheeks to those who pulled out the beard. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. The song of the suffering servant on behalf of us. So now we come to Isaiah 53, the last of the songs of the suffering servant. Let me tell you a little bit more about Isaiah 53. This passage was so important. Jesus referred to Isaiah 53. The apostles referred to Isaiah 53. In the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, 1 Timothy, Titus, Hebrews, 1 Peter, and 1 John all refer to Isaiah 53. The fifth gospel. All refer to Isaiah 53. No Old Testament chapter is used as much as Isaiah 53 in the whole of the Old Testament. And no chapter is leveraged as much as the New Testament writers to make their point about who Jesus was and what Jesus did. No chapter in the Old Testament is used as much and is leveraged as much by the New Testament writers as Isaiah 53. No other Old Testament passage describes the death of Christ, the burial of Christ, the resurrection of Christ, and the intercession of Christ. No other Old Testament chapter describes these. Now, you could read Psalm 22, which is one of the most quoted psalms in the New Testament. And there are segments out of Psalm 22 that's used. But it pales in comparison to how many times Isaiah 53 is used. And no other body of literature in the Old Testament covers the expanse of the death of Christ, the burial of Christ, the resurrection of Christ, and the intercession of Christ. No other text. This chapter answers the most important question in the history of the world. So I stated it before, I'll say it again. How can a sinner, alienated and cut off from God, become right with God in order to escape hell and enter into a right relationship with an eternal and holy God in heaven? Isaiah 53 answers that question. And this is the question that should always be ever before us during the Lenten season. It should be the question that we meditate on, that we think, that we pray about, so that our faith is renewed and our appreciation is deepened and our love becomes more profound for the great work that Jesus Christ did for us. So the final suffering servant song in Isaiah explains how the Holy One can bless sinful people. So we begin with Isaiah 52, because Isaiah 52, 13 through 15, really ought to be a part of Isaiah 53. It was a poor break for those people who did the chapter and verse thing. And so almost every commentator says the same thing. That was a miss, right? Probably while they were riding on horseback. I don't know if you know it, but one of the guys who broke the Bible up into chapters and verses was legally blind. And so he still did a magnificent work, but maybe the horse bumped something on the road, and he, oh, okay, here we are, you know, Isaiah 50. Maybe it was that kind of thing, I don't know. But let's go to the suffering servant in Isaiah 52. So turn to 52, verses 13 through 15. I'm going to spend a few minutes on this so that we can begin a deeper look into this magnificent psalm that's so important and so compelling. Isaiah 52, verses 13 through 15. Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up, and shall be exalted. And so when we read this first verse here, it's like, wow. I mean, this is quite a person, right? I mean, this person is really significant. They must have done some amazing things. People are honoring him. That he must be a person of great importance and has accomplished great things, and that's why he's going to be high and lifted up and exalted. Here is a faithful servant, a faithful slave who served his master well, who did everything that was asked of him. This is a great guy, right? And then we read in verse 14, there's this sudden switch, this massive movement between that to, as many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. He was so disfigured that he ceased to look human. Well, how does a person go from being honored and lifted up high to this happening to them? I mean, how is that possible? So again, you know, for those people who were deeply invested in most of the kind of Judaism that was practiced in that day, they would have seen this as like unreconcilable. You can't have a person who is honored, who is lifted high and exalted on one hand, and yet suffer this kind of a thing, because in their mind, excuse me, anybody who suffered, like they are describing in verse 14, that is a person who is cursed by God. People who are high and lifted up and who are exalted, excuse me, they don't get cursed by God. So this would have been a weird thing for people to have read. How is this possible? It's a stunning contrast. No Israelite then would have believed that this was possible. This man had to be cursed. Honor and exaltation always happen because people who get it live respectable and godly lives. People who are abused in this fashion are abused because of some great sin in their lives. And understand this. Because of us, there was great sin in the life of the suffering servant. And that sin was our sin. And the suffering that he endured was the suffering that was meant for us. But then we go to verse 15. So he shall sprinkle many nations. Kings shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. And so, as with most prophetic literature, as with most parables, there's a cryptic nature. The word cryptic means hidden, oftentimes meaning that there are many different helpful interpretations of what you could derive from that crypticness. So shall he sprinkle. So he goes from being high and exalted and lifted up to being horribly abused, and yet even because, despite the horrible abuse that he goes through, to a point where he doesn't look human anymore, the effect of how he acted wisely or effectively means that he will sprinkle many nations. And so there are two things that you can derive from that word sprinkle. Sprinkle implies being covered in redemptive blood. So when it says that the many nations are sprinkled, I want you to visual quite literally the nations throughout the world being sprinkled with the blood of Christ. And these pools of faith, these pools and communities of faith emerge. And we are covered by the blood. That's why we're here, because that blood covers us and cleanses us. It also raises the image of blood being sprinkled on the mercy seat by the high priest on the Day of Atonement. So the Day of Atonement, which is the holiest day on the Jewish calendar, where the high priest would go in and take the blood of the lamb, the perfect lamb that was unblemished, and he would take that blood, he would take a hyssop, cleanse me with a hyssop, remember that? In Psalm 51, he would take that hyssop with the blood of the lamb and he would sprinkle it on the mercy seat on the Day of Atonement, the day of at-one-ment with God. Does that make sense to you? So great sections of humanity will be covered by the blood of his righteous, suffering servant. And then we read here, well, kings will shut their mouths because of him. Why will they shut their mouths? I mean, these are the most powerful people, right? They will shut their mouths because of the message. They will be stunned by what they hear when they hear the account of what this suffering servant did for us and for them. Kings will shut their mouths because of him, for that which had not been told them they see, that which they have not heard they understand. So kings, the most powerful man on the planet, would be silenced by the significance of his great works. Kings who were also the most informed and oftentimes the best educated men of their day, who were ignorant, would now become informed. And even kings will see the significance of what this suffering servant did, and they will be swayed. They will turn to faith. So when people would have heard this read, I mean, it would have just been this unbelievable description. How is it possible that you can have a person who's exalted on one hand, abased utterly on the other, and yet despite that, this is a person whose work would be so profound that even the most powerful people in the world would shut their mouths because of him and would be influenced and changed because of him. That's what's going on in Isaiah 52, verses 13 through 15. And if those words don't impact us, then we have hard hearts. We have hard hearts if those words do not impact us. Because Isaiah wrote those words, and in God's mind, we were there. We were there. I mean, it's almost like we were already existent because we were in God's mind when Isaiah uttered these words. And aren't you glad that we were in God's mind?